Hey everyone, I'm Emily Cassie, the director, producer, and cinematographer of Sugarcane.
And I'm Christopher Lamarca, the director of photography on Sugarcane.
And you're listening to the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey, Ben Rock. Welcome back to another fine episode of, if I can say it, the Cinematography Podcast.
I think we should leave that in. Hey, Ilya Friedman, how's it going? How you doing?
It's going pretty well. Hey, who is on our show today?
Okay, so there's an amazing documentary called Sugarcane that you can currently watch on Nat Geo. So if you have Disney Plus or Hulu, you should be able to see it. And it's a pretty big deal documentary about the way Indigenous people were treated in Canada, where the children of Indigenous people were literally indoctrinated in Catholic schools and their culture sort of by design removed from them. And this isn't like 1850, like the last of these schools, I believe, closed in 1997. And we have basically co-director and co-cinematographer Emily Cassie and other co-cinematographer Christopher Lamarca. And they're here to kind of talk about this very intimate process that they did that took a long time. I mean, it was like a 3-year process. And when you see this movie, I think it's kind of important that it's like, yeah, she's an investigative journalist by trade. That's her whole background. And she talks about that. But like, this is almost a character piece of a documentary where it's like really getting into the lives of the people that it's covering. And it's very, very, very intimate. And they talk about, I think this is an interesting interview if you're someone who's looking to make a documentary or even narrative film, but you wanted to pare it down and have almost no crew. Often it was just the two of them. And like they even handled sound. They didn't have a sound person. And they talk at great length about that. And anyway, it's a fascinating film. I also wanted to ask you, and I intentionally didn't ask you before now, you just went to Australia. How'd it go?
It went really well, actually. Australia was a super productive trip. I took the new Betty Luminous reflector system down there, and it's currently working on a Charlize Theron movie for the next 3 months. So
what?
I know. So yeah, it'd be pretty cool. A friend of the show, Larry Shear, is the DP of the project. It is for Netflix. It also stars Taron Egerton and Eric Bana. So yeah, it should be really good.
That's got to be a very satisfying feeling to be like you made a product and it's being used by a DP of that stature with stars of that stature.
For the first time, yeah, absolutely. It is for the first feature film. It was used 2 weeks ago in New York on a Rachel Zegler commercial spot shot by a DP named Dave Brick, who a friend of mine for a long time now. And I got to say, it looked fantastic, and I'm really, really happy that we got a little bit of experience with it just before heading off to Australia. But the production down there is rocking and rolling. They're shooting a really difficult job in the bush for the most part for like the next 3 months, and there is some studio work, but I'm very excited. I can't wait to see what they do with it. We are building more of them right now. I've got another potential customer coming up who really wants to see it in the next few weeks. So I'm going to try and figure that out. So anyway, that's what I'm working on.
Wow. We should do a segment at some point where we talk at great length about this and the creation of it. I think it'd be great to hear more about it.
I'd be happy to. It'll be a lot of fun.
And now, Close Focus.
So Ben, it is an interesting time for the industry right now. There is
interesting time for literally everybody.
It continues to get more interesting. I know Sundance has been going on, and Sundance I think is now over. Sundance, yeah, definitely over. But it was a weird Sundance. What's your take on Sundance for our Close Focus this week?
Well, the initial vibe on Sundance was that it was a failure this year, which turns out really not to be true. Mm. And what it was a lot of historically Sundance would, like, a lot of the big sales would happen at the beginning in the first few days or the first week. And like, it had kind of a normal number of sales, but most of them happened towards the end of the festival. It's interesting to kind of scroll through the buyers, you know, because, you know, we're both, you know, elderly enough to, you know, remember when it was just a completely different slate of buyers. So now it's like, I mean, there are some like HBO films buying a lot of documentaries, and that's something HBO has always been amazing at. But, you know, you'll like Mubi, who had an amazing runaway success with The Substance last year. You know, they pop up more than they have in the past. A24, obviously, Neon, obviously. I'd say those are like the, like in the narrative world, those are the ones, those are the big ones. You know, there was a time where it was Lionsgate or Artisan before that, or obviously Miramax, Weinstein Company. Like, those companies just aren't really on as much of the radar of the buyers. But I think the biggest news about Sundance, and what all of us are talking about, is this is the second to last year that it will be in Park City, Utah, supposedly. I mean, like, obviously they could change their mind tomorrow, but, you know, Sundance has been synonymous with Park City for, you know, over 40 years, right? Like, it's,
yeah,
been
for
there,
sure.
That's where it's been forever. And, you know, I remember my first Sundance, and, you know, I've been several times. I think you've been more times than I have. And I wonder, I know we've talked about this on the podcast, but like, I just wonder about like what essentially about the character of the festival is going to change as soon as it's not in Park City. Cause I sort of feel like they are one in the same. If you are in Park City, I guess there are people who go there to ski in the middle of Sundance Film Festival, but really people are there for the film festival, and it's a ski resort town otherwise. And it's a small town.
It is, you know, we've talked a little bit about this threatening to move scenario before, and in some regards, it is going to move no matter what. Even the one that is not really a move, which is staying partially in Park City and moving much of the festival down to Salt Lake City. I'd heard from a couple people was sort of like an insidery way to get more money, was a way for the festival to get more you know, concessions from the state in order to keep it going. Now, Sundance, to my knowledge, has the absolute highest dollar rates for sponsorships of any sort of like festival out there, specifically one for, you know, indie films like this. So my understanding was the entry, and this is going back probably almost 20 years ago, the entry level to sponsor Sundance, if you wanted to be an official Sundance sponsor, was about $250,000. So $250,000, $250,000, was what was required for the minimum level to sponsor Sundance. I have to imagine that in the last, you know, 18 years or so, it's only gone up. So they have huge sponsors, tons of sponsors, lots and lots of big sponsors, presenting sponsors, and there's this whole economy that goes on, which are not official sponsors. They just sort of take over the town, that take over all that stuff.
Yeah.
To have all that pick up and transplant somewhere else, they could certainly do it, but it's interesting because, you know, you and I have been reading articles about this, you know, leading up to this episode, and it seems to be that there is some consensus that Sundance has never really captured sort of its magic from pre-pandemic. Had a big drop-off, moved to being a combination online and in-person hybrid, and they've never gotten rid of all of that, and probably they shouldn't. But at the same time, it doesn't feel as crowded. It doesn't feel as, you know, I guess quite as magical as it used to be, I guess, because, you know, times have changed, things have shifted.
Yeah.
And with that delay of acquisitions, I think it gave sort of, you know, the press an opportunity to really, you know, hold Sundance's feet to the fire and say, look, you guys thought you were all that. And clearly this year is showing that it's not. And then, of course, it turns out that the reports of their demise was greatly exaggerated because suddenly the industry showed up and bought a bunch of stuff. So
it's doing just fine. I guess, you know, like, so the three main contenders in the Where Will Sundance End Up next pageant are Salt Lake City, like you said, Boulder, Colorado, and Cincinnati, Ohio. And all of those are interesting, but I feel like all of them are also like kind of like I've been to all of those cities. They're all cities, you know, mm-hmm. like that are having their own lives going on. And, you know, the thing about Sundance is like when you were there, if you were seeing a movie at the Eccles or you were seeing a movie at the library or whatever, it's like you probably there were a couple of years where I drove from L.A. to there. So I had my own car. And there actually was for a while not horrible parking, but the last mm-hmm. time I was there was 2019 and there was no parking at all and everybody was Ubering and Lyfting around the town. And but it was like you were in kind of this weird little bubble that what like no matter where you went, it was Sundance. No matter who you ran into at a restaurant or waiting online or on a bus, it was somebody who was a serious cinephile or someone who made a movie or someone who was in a movie or someone who was a critic of a movie. It was like you were kind of like
it was Peter Dinklage. Like literally you'd walk down the street and it would be Peter Dinklage or it would be somebody else yeah. who yeah
you were just hermetically yeah. sealed and yeah. like I've been to other big festivals like Tribeca, for instance, and Tribeca's in New York City. And it's like there's not really a central hub for Tribeca. So the festival it's an amazing festival. They throw great parties. They do awesome stuff. But like right outside on the other side of this wall, New York City is still New York City-ing along. It doesn't have the same insulated vibe. Insulated is kind of what Sundance, it's part of the brand, in my opinion. When you go to Sundance, that's what you're going for. And also it's like generally like cripplingly cold there.
Yeah.
So like agreed. You just want to get inside and go see a movie because that's how you're going to stay warm. And I feel like if we go to Cincinnati, I mean, even Boulder's, I think it's a ski resort town. I don't know. I don't ski, but
I was just going to say, I have heard that Telluride has that same feel and that Telluride I've never been, but it's yeah, I've never insulated been that it's very difficult to get to. And when you get there, it's like, you don't want to go anywhere. Interesting. I would say that, Camera Image, which is you know, it's a city in Poland. It's not quite the same sort of thing. Does still feel quite insulated when you're in there. It's cold. They keep all the theaters very close together, so it's like everything is within sort of a very short distance. I think that festivals that do that do sort of capture hearts and minds, but they're harder for the average person to go to. It's harder to get into spaces like that if you're talking about.
No, it's true. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, if they put it in Cincinnati, I think that like a whole bunch of people from the Midwest are going to be exposed to a bunch of movies that they never would have seen otherwise. And you know, I don't think it's a bad in no way do I think that moving is a bad thing. I very strongly associate them with Park City, and I think it's really cool. Like, I love Park City, and I'll probably never go back once they move. Like, I doubt I'll ever go back to Park City, Utah. But you know, it's going to be the Sundance Film Festival, but I guess the real question is, how is it going to change when it isn't in a hermetically sealed thing? Like, Salt Lake City to me is the least change because they've always done screenings in Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City is a 40-minute drive from Park City.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure how it's going to change either, but it will radically change the tourist dollars that go to Sundance. I know that in the short 2 weeks of Sundance, all the local merchants get to jack up their prices. All, you know, there's yeah. people there who make triple their typical sort of like, you know, short term Airbnb / you know, VRBO sort of rentals. It is a massive boon for the local economy. Well, that they probably don't get the rest of that. They,
well, what's going to happen season. When we go to yeah. like a normal city that just has regular old hotels? Because like, you know, everything at Park City is a ski lodge. So, you know, like 10 people will go in on one place because, you know, every surface is a sleepable surface. Yeah. But when we're in Cincinnati and we're just in a regular old city in Ohio, you know, what's that going to be like?
I think it might morph the festival into something a little bit more like South by Southwest, because South by Southwest has grown and continued to grow. And of course, it was mostly a music festival, but the film festival and all the other sorts of stuff that they do, being in a larger place that then you go into the city and you're not just, you know, you're not just in this thing, allows Sundance to probably become a more of a mecca. Maybe that's their goal. Maybe that's their be all end all. I don't know if that's the case, but if they're trying to do something to become a little bit more South by, they're going to need a heck of a lot more infrastructure, and maybe that's their goal. Maybe that's where they're headed.
Well, I think that kind of wraps it up. But yeah, I mean, I would encourage anyone to check it out. Look at the films that got picked up at Sundance, because those are the movies we're going to be covering them in the next year, some of them. And some of them are going to be at the Oscars next year this time.
Undoubtedly. All right, Ben, we should get to the interview with the creative team from Sugarcane.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Well, so first off, congratulations for, you know, I mean, like this film has been doing amazingly on the festival circuit as well as, you know, Oscar nomination. That's huge. Congratulations. If you could just kind of tell me the genesis of the story, and, you know, especially with a documentary like this, I'm always curious, what was the process? How long were you filming? You know, like what was, you know, were you with them constantly? Who were you with? Like, how did you break all that up? And how much of the story did you have in your head? You know, all the stuff. Tell me all the stuff.
Well, it's really good to be here, Ben, and really special to get to talk with Chris today, which, you know, our partnership has been a really, really tremendous one as well. I'm a documentary filmmaker and investigative journalist, and I've spent the last decade in newsrooms telling stories about human rights abuses and conflicts all over the world. And I was kind of a one-woman band shooting, editing, et cetera, directing. Mm-hmm. I had never thought to turn my lens on my own country and the horrors that it perpetrated against its first peoples. I'm born and raised in Canada, and both Canada and the United States had a system of systematically removing six generations of Native kids from their homes and families and forcibly assimilating them at these schools called residential schools or boarding schools. There were 139 of them in Canada and 417 federally funded schools in the United States. And at these schools, these kids faced unimaginable abuse and horrors that went largely unknown and undocumented until now. So despite this being the foundational story of North America and how the land was taken from Indigenous peoples, most of us didn't know. And so I was horrified when I heard, and I felt compelled towards the story, this kind of gut pull. And the other thing I felt compelled to do was to reach out to my friend Julian, who directed the film with me. And Julian and I worked our first reporting jobs together almost a decade ago. We were cub reporters in a newsroom together. And in the years since, he had become this incredible writer and journalist on life in North America. He himself is Indigenous. And I asked him if he wanted to work with me on the residential school story, and he said he'd think about it. In the meantime, I went looking for a nation that said they were going to do a search, and I found an article in the Williams Lake Tribune about Chief Willie Sellers in the Williams Lake First Nation. I wrote Chief Willie a cold email. He called me back that same afternoon and said, "The creator has always had great timing. Just yesterday, said, we need someone to document this search." So I got my camera gear together, and I was about to go to Williams Lake. And 2 weeks later, I heard back from Julian, and he said he'd be open to working with me. I said, "That's great. I'm going to follow a search at the school called St. Joseph's Mission in this town called Williams Lake." And Julian went silent. And that's when he said, "That's really crazy. That's the school my family attended and where my father was born nearby and put in a dumpster, and that's all I've ever known."
Oof.
So of 139 schools in Canada, I happened to choose the one school that Julian's family attended and where we would later find out his father was actually born in the dormitories and found in the school's incinerator, which is a big part of the film. So
this spoiler alert.
Yeah, in so many ways. It was fated in so many ways. And the other thing that was fated was bringing Chris onto the project. You know, I knew that I wanted to shoot this thing to camera. I knew that I wanted someone with an incredibly sensitive approach, an intimate approach, and who could shoot the film in the way it deserved to be, which was, you know, as a work of cinema, as an immersive work of cinema. And so I reached out to a friend of mine who he had shot with and asked, you know, her for, you know, I said, "Who'd shot this film? Can you send me his name?" And she just sent me his name and number. I called Chris. I'll let him tell his kind of perspective on that. But Chris and I met in Williams Lake with our camera gear, picked him up at the airport and looked at each other. And in that moment, kind of knew that this partnership was going to work. And from there, we shot 160 days together over 2.5 years living in the community on and off in this small town. So I'll let Chris jump in.
Really just kind of add to what Emily was saying. Being a cinematographer in this realm and in this world, I get calls all the time. And usually the biggest red flag for a call is when someone calls and wants to do a verite film. And it's kind of become a term that people don't fully understand. And especially directors, they don't fully understand what that means. And one of the biggest draws for me to, commit to the first shoot was the fact that Emily was also a shooter as well as a director. And that...
Yeah, you both take cinematography credit on the film.
Yeah, of course. And that was a big motivation for me, because again, you have a director in these situations and think that they understand and how they want to tell a story in this way. But unless you're behind the camera and you're engaged and immersed in this way, there's still a huge disconnect. And it was very clear from early on that Emily was fully committed. She had a voice and a vision, and she was really down for this arduous journey. And people who shoot verite understand that and understand what it really takes. And it's really the most special way to make films.
So, well, let me ask you, and I'd like to ask both of you, when you're talking about verite, and you're saying that people will ask for it, but it can be an issue. So what's the correct way to approach verite for both of you?
Well, I'll say the first and big ingredient is time. And this is the thing with this specific aspect of this medium, is that you need time to really shoot this way, right? And this is the one thing, and especially now there's been a lot of contractions in our fields. You can't make up for time with people. And a lot of that is just spending time without cameras at first and really dropping in and seeing if things are kind of energetically working before you pick up the camera. So for me, that's the biggest thing. And that's what I'm saying, that people don't really understand what it takes. You think they kind of show up, you want to get into things and get in real close and get out. And that's not how it works. So it's more of a way of being than just a way of being as a cinematographer.
To build on that, it is what comes with time is trust and intimacy. And so for me, it was so important to earn the trust of this community that has been, ravaged by colonization, that has been lied to and betrayed by white people since they arrived on the land. And so so important that we came in the most sensitive way possible and to really live with them as they were experiencing this. And the only way to get those real moments, those actual kind of aha moments to see someone transform emotionally, is for them to trust you so much that you're just there for all of these moments of their lives. And one thing that we decided to do was to shoot most of the film on prime lenses. And that was a big kind of change for me, coming from the journalism world, where you had to be really, be able to get things quickly. I was mostly shooting on zoom lenses, but with a prime lens, you really have to, you have to have time and space, and you also have to have earned the trust to be as close to the participants in the film as you want to be. Because as you can see in the film, most of it is pretty close.
Yeah.
And that came from years of really getting to know people and them really trusting that we would hold that space for them. And also learning them, right? There's a moment in the film where Rick Gilbert, who, just a little bit of context, is an elder in the community who went to the school. He's a survivor and also carries this very dark secret that I won't give away. A very dark secret. And he goes all the way to the Vatican to really reckon with the secret he's been holding. And there's a moment where he's sitting on a bus in the Vatican and he hears a name that means a lot in the context of the story. And I knew from that point, in that moment, that Rick's tick, when he gets uncomfortable or something is moving within him, is his hand. And so I knew in that moment, tilt down to his hand. And it's a kind of very natural movement that kind of speaks to his interiority. But the only way that I could have known that, that I could have processed what that name would mean to him and to know where on his body energetically to follow, you know, the lens, was by gaining that trust over time.
That's really interesting. And I'm wondering too, like, as someone who is an investigative journalist, like, you always hear stories about investigative journalists, like, doing the same thing you're describing here, like, you know, getting a difficult interview subject and gaining their trust. Did the background in investigative journalism help with that? Or, I mean, what I feel like I'm hearing for both of you is like, you just were human beings and went to the space where they were and got to know them. But like, they know you're there to make a film. Like, they know that that's coming eventually, right? Like, I guess I'm curious about how the investigative journalism, like, the angle, like, what that taught you that made you able to get like this close with this community.
I think for me, the investigative journalism as part of my practice was really helpful in the actual investigation in the film. There's a very rigorous investigation that I was a part of, documenting it and actually helping with some of the investigative pieces of it. And that helped with this kind of drumbeat and rhythm of the film and helped gain the trust of the investigative team because they could see what I could bring to the table. But in terms of filming our characters, I think that's all about human connection. Both Chris and I feel that way. I think being a director with a camera is all about how you relate to people and how safe they feel with you. And that is, to be honest, kind of all heart, which Chris has a huge one. And I like to think mine is,
I can tell, yeah,
is pretty open as well. And I think that's really what allowed us to connect, to be shooting partners together, because we connect to people in a very similar way. And I think that's the heart of what you feel when you watch the film.
So as far as your shooting partnership went, are you both shooting at the same time? Are you shooting at different times? Are you both operating, or, you know, like, Emily, are you interviewing people while Chris is shooting, or how did you break that up? Or was it, you know, I can't tell if it was more like jazz, like you just did what needed to be done in the moment.
Yeah, that's a great word for it.
I love that, jazz.
I mean, improvisational jazz.
You can use it in your Oscar speech. That's cool. Yeah.
we'll plug it for you. I mean, like, you know, in even in that realm, kind of to push it, you know, a little bit further, is like, it's almost like you finding the right discipline between discipline and almost like the full willingness to let go into a space of like almost reckless abandon. So we show up with an approach, an idea, how we're going to be together regarding to the space. What is it like with the people that are there? What is the light like there? So we'll show up there together. But most importantly, we are completely being adaptive to what's happening in the room. Mm. And that's how this kind of magic happens, is really being able to let go and trust in yourself. And in those situations, Emily and I have to trust in each other. So we start a shorthand through our eyes and how we're looking at each other, and also through the lenses that we're using. So the majority of it was, we were shooting on a 35 and a 50. Mm-hmm. In those focal lengths and in regards to the room and what's happening, Emily and I are gauging each other and moving accordingly. So we're moving in unison because we're also thinking about the edit, right?
Yeah.
As things are happening, we're also kind of like thinking ahead and making sure not only is everything technically working, but what's happening here artistically. And that was always just as important for the story for both of us.
Yeah, I love that idea of kind of improvisational jazz, because it is what it felt like. It felt like a kind of connection between us, a connection to our characters, where we could look at each other and know where to move and how to move. And if I saw Chris transition to something different, I knew what he was doing and I could compliment that, or vice versa. And there were moments, like there's this one scene where like I just could not get the shot, And it's a big scene in the film where Julian and his father show up to kind of Julian's father's childhood bully's home, who reveals a bunch of very important information. It's a big confrontation and it happened very quickly. And there was one really beautiful, easier shot and one very difficult one. And I just kind of like looked at him and was like, you know, we have to switch because I just couldn't get it. And I trusted that he could. So there were moments like that, that were, you know, that were just, it was a real partnership in that way. And then there were moments where we had to split up. I never wasn't shooting because I don't know how to direct not shooting. But there are certain things that like, I really love that Chris does that I, you know, where we would split up and on different characters. So like, if we were all at the river shooting, you know, some of the dip netting that you see, like I wanted to be with the kids, maybe at one point, and Chris was like actually filming some of the big movements along the water on a more precarious ledge. He's like much more physically stable than I am. So there was that, you know, the physicality of our bodies as well. And then there was a moment, you know, where, which was a big trust moment for me. I felt like very attached to Chris being there a lot of the time because it made me feel like if I fucked up, sorry, I don't know if I can say that, but if I fucked up, you know, he had me. And so there was this moment where Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, was going to visit the community to apologize at the very moment where Rick was going to go to the Vatican to be part of the Pope's apology. So Chris, poor guy, had to stay with Justin Trudeau, and I shot Rome without him. And that was a big moment for me of like, can I do this without him? But at that point I had learned so much from him, and it's like the thing that I'm most proud of in what I shot of the film, because it's a reflection of the vision that we built together. And that I was able to have the confidence at that point to really shoot it in the way that we envisioned it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it definitely felt like one of a piece too, you know, like what, watching it, there was never a point where I'm like, well, this was clearly shot by someone else. It all felt very, cohesive. Now I want to ask about the idea of shooting on prime lenses. Was it just because zoom lenses are bigger, heavier, more unwieldy, and more like, what was it? Was it about the intimacy level? Like having
well, you have to move your body, right, Ben? You got to move your body with a prime lens. You can't be over there and then just zoom in to the person. You have to physically be close with them, and you can feel that through the lens. He might say something more insightful.
I don't know about that, but I think the number one thing, honestly, Ben, with it is just the way that the prime lenses, they just render the face and they render space differently than a zoom does. I mean, unless you're shooting on like, you know, some crazy expensive ingenues or something like that, and that's all tech thing, blah, blah, blah. But in terms of what we were doing and what was available to us, I feel that there's nothing better than being on a prime lens and being in the physical proximity of someone as if you were having a conversation with them. That does something to the viewer psychologically and does something to them personally and spiritually, because what happens there in that moment is that the viewer now feels like they're in the room with the characters and they're on the shoulders of the character. And they're not being told something from across the room, but they're feeling something in a very visceral, close, somatic way. And prime lenses, I have found, are the best way to transmit that kind of feeling.
No, I get it. I mean, like you guys pointed out my camera, this is a 50 millimeter lens right here. So
No, you look great. And I would also just say, I think it's really important. It was really important for Julian and I, when we were talking about, you know, what this film was as a refutation of, you know, earlier documentary practices that positioned Indigenous people from an arm's length as kind of this primitive, you know, people. And there was like the original documentary is Nanook of the North, which is a total fabrication of what life was like, where Robert Flaherty literally called them a simple people, where he had them reenact like biting on a phone and pretending that they didn't know modern technology, changing their names to something more palatable for white audience, and also fathering kids up there and then leaving them behind. I mean, a lot of ethical problems there, but I think for Julian, it was so important from a directorial view that this film cinematically was visually also a refutation of that original conception, and so that also played into how we wanted to shoot it.
I never thought about the Nanook of the North reputation. Yeah, and like in film school, I think like a lot of people, I have seen that film, and even then, you know, in film school, our professor was like, "Yeah, this is all bullshit. You know, like none of this is real." You know, but it's kind of the birth of documentary as opposed to kind of where we're at now. Now, what actual, not to go too far down the weeds technically, but like what camera were you guys using?
We were shooting on Canon gear. I was shooting on the C500 Mark II. Emily was shooting on the C300 Mark II. And you know, it's we can go into a lot of different avenues for that. But I think the one thing that really kind of gets overlooked when we talk about the gear is that this gear also allowed us to run our own sound. And Emily and I ran our own sound on this film.
I
And
was curious about that because it sounds like it was just the two of you there or the
yeah, it's
three of
one thing
you.
that no one talks about, which is actually kind of the best compliment you can get. But I also feel like I always kind of want to talk about it because of how important it is to a story, especially a story like this. And when I think about the gear, I think about more of how it enabled us to run the sound and really to get the image that we needed. Because to be in these spaces that we were, just having that one other person, and especially with a boom mic in people's faces, that just one doesn't align for this kind of story. And it's also for Emily and myself, we're very sensitive, and that kind of energy will shift things in a room, you know, very, 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 very quickly. And with that being said, I just, you know, a location sound is its own art form. And I have learned everything that I know I've learned from dear friends of mine who are location sound people. And we were able to take those tools, take that skill set for Emily and I, and really try and still create that immersive sound experience like there was a sound person there. And that's something I'm really proud of that we haven't really talked about.
Yeah, we never talk about it, but it is, you know, also coming from my background in visual journalism, like you don't have a sound person as well. So it was always what I was used to. And we just, I think what was also really important is that what we did with lavs is that, first of all, to be able to put a lav on someone is a very intimate thing. And for us to be the ones to do that when they already trusted us. They ended up knowing how to lav themselves by the end, but it happens at the very beginning of the day, and then they forget all about it, and it just becomes like part of, you know, it allows people to just free up, and then all they have to worry about is, and hopefully they don't worry at all, is about the two of us being in their spaces, and so that was really key. It was also really important that we could hear very clearly the dialogue, because for me, I'm thinking also, you know, and Chris is too, of course, but I'm thinking about like the moments that are going to play out in the film in context of the other scenes. So I really needed to be in tune with everything that was being said so that I could also be like, oh, they just discovered this one thing which actually connects to something else we found with a different character. So like I'm also trying to connect the dots as part of the investigation piece with it, right? There's like the energetic capturing the moments, but there's also thinking about the bigger plot and the investigation and how all of these things were going to work together. So it was very important that we were like fully tuned in this very immersive experience of what was happening in front of us.
Can I ask you kind of just a general storytelling question about how you went about doing this? So you're shooting for, you said 160 days of shooting. So you're connecting something on day 25 that comes back up on day 112, right?
Absolutely.
How were you working on the edit while you were doing it? Were you taking extensive notes? Did you have transcripts? Like what did you do to make it easier for yourself to make those connections? Because I don't know how a human brain could contain everything that you saw in 160 days, or are you just that good? And that maybe that's the answer. I don't know.
You know, I had a few different tools. I mean, I did all the logging of the footage. Which was helpful because I just kind of like knew what we had and I was organizing it as well. So I kind of knew what was there, knew what was on the drive, and would look back at things. But I didn't create logs of like what we had of every single day until much later in the edit. I did have like folders with all the documents we had discovered. But honestly, a lot of it was just, I think you have to understand that this is all I did for 3.5 years. Like, it is the only
Wow.
thing I did. I did nothing else. I like sometimes went home and slept. And
Sometimes.
sometimes I would go home and sleep and like rest for a bit. But even then, I was always thinking about the film. Like, I was living and breathing this 24/7 for 3.5 years, which sounds a little bit crazy, but I truly did not work on another thing in any other way. And so it really lived in my body and in my mind, and became like an index. Like, I really knew every priest who worked at the school, who had been convicted, what abuses we knew about, what letters I had. If there was a moment in the archive where Charlene discovered a letter from one priest to another about a girl who had gone missing, and then I knew that that was a name we had looked for in the death records, like, and then that was a name that came up when we did this one. When we did this one, not interview, but we were filming someone and they talked about this girl, like all of those things would just kind of connect in a sort of, like a beautiful mind where he's like all of the things, like that felt in many ways like the inside of my head for a long time.
Yeah, I just like, I mean, even like, we talk to a lot of people who make, narrative features, but they'll be shooting it for like 3 months or something. And it's like, how do you, how do you, if you had to shoot a piece of a scene 2.5 months ago, even pulling up dailies and stuff, like how do you keep the arc of everything all clear? And this movie has several threads. So like, there's a lot. Watching it, there's a lot of different threads to kind of follow, several different characters, and so I can imagine, especially given how many days you shot it, like, there's, I can, again, I can only imagine how many interesting or horrifying plot lines you weren't able to include just because you're trying to, mash it down into a feature length, but like keeping track of all of those various threads sounds, very, very complicated. I'm always interested in people's organizational system for how they keep it all straight, especially something like this where you both are doing it for so long. So if you were on it for 3.5 years, Chris, how long were you involved?
We've all been in it. That's the thing about this. There's been no separation in this creative process in most ways. And the one thing I wanted to add, thinking about that in terms of like logging and being organized, the best and most important thing that we did as a team in the field was download every night. And once we get together, once we come home, what you're doing in that moment is that you're recalling all of the things that hit your heart the hardest and penetrated the deepest. And in that moment, that's where the film starts to get made, not on paper, not logging in Adobe Premiere, but from the heart level, being totally, totally clear and focused on what was happening in the day. Where were we the most moved? Where did we feel connected? Where did we feel disconnected? And as that would kind of marinate over time and over the years, night after night after night, you're making the film within your own head and heart without any computers and without any technology. And that is the continuation, and that was the foundation of our organization, of our edit, of our pacing, of our connection to make this beautiful film that we made.
And I'll just then paint a picture for you. What that looked like was Julian and I on the couch eating a lot of snacks and going like back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And then Chris stretching, just doing like incredible stretching movements because he's very physical when he shoots. And so he's got to like work that stuff out or he's going to hurt himself. He's stretching. And then once in a while, he'll stop. And he'll turn to us. And Julian and I, we like the way we brainstorm, we're just like kind of spit firing. And then Chris would do like a monologue on like something that really moved him. And that we would be like, whoa. It was like this very incredible creative collaboration and family that we created in the field that was very special and particular to this film.
Okay, well, I think that uses up all of our time. I feel like I could talk to you guys for another hour and a half about it. Before we go, I just wanted to remind people to check it out. You can see it on Disney Plus right now. It's on National Geographic on Disney Plus, Sugarcane. It's a beautiful, intimate, wonderful film nominated for Best Documentary. And we'll be looking out for you at the Oscars. Can't wait to see you all. You already have your tickets. You already have your seats and all that stuff.
We're working on it, Ben. But we really appreciate you having us. It's a real treat for us to get to speak about, you know, the cinematography and the visual vision for this film. So thank you so much.
Yeah, it's amazing for us because, you know, as you both know, there are as many ways to make a documentary as any other kind of film. And I love hearing about, you know, this kind of intimate yet journalistic approach that the two of you have taken. And I think it's a really special film, and I hope lots of people check it out.
All right, Ben, that was great. I'm so glad that you got to do that interview. Now it is time to pay the bills. We got to thank our fine friends over at Aperture, makers of all kinds of lighting equipment, predominantly lighting equipment and lighting accessories for the motion picture and television industry. They also have a really incredible YouTube channel, and I want to give it a shout out this week as part of our thank yous to our sponsor. They have been doing usually product related information on there, but occasionally they branch out and they do some education, and they do some stuff that's a little bit similar to the stuff that we do. Like, for example, they had Johnny Durango on recently to talk about flight risk. So that he's in their most recent episode, which is great. The other thing I wanted to mention, though, is they do some other really good educational sort of stuff on there, including just in this past week, what's new in Cytuslink Pro, which is their proprietary remote control application, essentially, which allows you to control their lights. But they also do a very good video, which is all about DMX. And you probably know this because you are a lighting theater guy. Do you know what DMX stands for, Ben?
Oh, I actually have no idea what it stands for, but I have all his albums. Go
on. Digital Multiplex. And there's a really great video from last week called What is Lighting Control and DMX? And in that video, it's actually episode 7, but if you are not familiar with DMX, it's a great video to watch to get a real primer, and it explains all of the different parameters and channels and ways in which lights are professionally controlled for stage, live event, and for professional cinema. I recommend giving it a watch. It is, very informative and really well put together. So take a look at the last few videos here on the Aperture YouTube channel, and you'll enjoy it. Thanks again for our sponsorship from Aperture. And of course, if you need any Aperture products or their Cytuslink products, reach out to Hot Rod Cameras, where all of their stuff is available.
And now, Short Ends.
So, Ben, it is our short end time of the show. What obscure, abstract obsession do you have this month to share with all our listeners?
This month?
Okay, this week.
We got to come up with four of them a month.
Yeah, it's true. So what is it today?
So this is maybe a niche thing that people of our age and older would only find interesting. But it's a documentary called Have You Got It Yet? The Story of Syd Barrett and Pink Floyd, directed by Roddy Bogawa and Storm Thorgerson.
Wow.
Pink Floyd was, you know, a psychedelic 60s, 70s. You can sort of call them an 80s. I mean, I guess, Pink Floyd, The Final Cut and The Wall. Did The Wall come out in 1980? Anyway, they're a very influential band, but they were founded by a guy named Syd Barrett, who famously went completely like schizophrenic, or like he lost his mind, and his family has forever blamed it on his rock and roll lifestyle, which appears to have included copious amounts of LSD. And I've always found him interesting, you know, like for people of probably our age, we probably got into Pink Floyd from Dark Side of the Moon forward, which was still early 70s, but like was very much in the culture well into my, well into the 80s. Mm. And you know, that, Wish You Were Here, The Wall, and a lot of those stories are substantially about Syd Barrett. Like Wish You Were Here is so about Syd Barrett. It's a really interesting film that has about as much footage of Syd Barrett that I've ever seen. And, you know, there's kind of an interesting world of tortured artists. You know, I mean, there's Vincent van Gogh or whatever, but even like in the music world, we have like Amy Winehouse or Keith Moon or Kurt Cobain. You have all these people. And I've just always found Syd Barrett to be kind of a weird point of interest because he was such an experimental musician, but also like, I feel like everything that Pink Floyd did from the moment that he left the band forward was about him in a weird way. It's a great documentary. It's on Prime Video. I saw it on Plex. But I think that it was just on the Plex server of someone who I share Plex servers with. Mm. But you can get it on Prime Video for $2. And if you're a Pink Floyd fan, it's definitely a must. They have interviews with the surviving members of Pink Floyd. It's a pretty well-made documentary, especially like all the archival stuff of Syd Barrett. And it's a bummer. It'll bum you out, but it's a good kind of bummer. You kind of see this guy who had all this potential, who actualized a lot of the potential, and who eventually just kind of wasn't able to keep doing what he was doing and kind of, you know, fell apart very quickly. But it's a really good documentary, worth checking out, especially if you're a Pink Floyd fan or if you're a fan of tortured artists in general.
Tortured artists definitely make for some of the best biographies and documentaries, no doubt.
Yeah. How about yourself, Ilya? What are you all about? I mean, like, I know you were in Australia. You've had a giant adventure. You know, I've gone from here to Traveltown and back, but you've been all over the place.
For everyone not in Los Angeles, Traveltown is a miniature and also full-size train sort of fun space for those under 9. Is that sort of the
yeah, age range? I mean, like, or if you're just a big train enthusiast, I suppose. But big, yeah, I mean, like, okay. I know some full-grown adults, but it's like, yeah, it's a bunch of trains that that for about a year and a half we had to take my son to every week or it was a meltdown. So we just went to Traveltown and it became like this grim thing in the middle of the pandemic when most of it was closed and you couldn't even go into the trains. You were Traveltown. You were traveling all over the place. So I want to know what's your thing this week? It's a big week for you, bigger week for you than anyone that I know, for sure.
Well, look, I'll just say that there's been, we're starting at the moment to get the announcements of new gear that is coming out. The BSC show, which is taking place in London, starts in the next couple of days. I'm not going this year. I had plenty of travel recently, so I'm not going to be heading out to the BSC. But
I hear the BSC is a BFD. Anyway, go on.
It is a BFD for sure. You know that I consult for a lot of different brands in the motion picture technology space, and one of those brands is a company called Tokina. I don't think I'm telling any tales out of school here, but since Tokina has started to get really serious about cinema style primes, which was their Vista line of primes, they've come out now with several versions. They had the Vista 1, then they had the Vista P, and just yesterday, so this is extremely timely, they've announced the Vista C. So Tokina Vistas, maybe not the best known to the lay audience out there, but they are sort of the internals for quite a few brands out there who have decided to rehouse them, who have decided to make them funkier, have more distortion or have more issues to make them more, you know, classic vintage style lenses. Now, Tokina has done a couple of things to basically, I want to say, detune and make their lenses a little bit more with what the market wants right now, because the market does not seem to really want the extremely sharp, extremely contrasty, extremely, you know, high performance lenses that everyone seemed to want in the era of film. It has sort of moved further and further away from that. So in response to that, because Tokina's Vista lenses on their own are just amazing works of art. They're absolutely beautiful. They're some of my favorite lenses. I personally own a set of the Vista ones and I love them. They now have a new set called the Vista Cs. The C stands for classic, even though they're not saying that, but this is a new optical formula. It is much more of that sort of like classic vintage sort of Cook Canon K35 sort of look that people are after. And these lenses are more expensive than the previous versions of them, but they have the new mechanics that they introduced with the Vista P, the new optics and the Vista C. I think this might be the set of lenses that really breaks through for Tokina. Tokina has never had the name recognition that, let's say, some other big major companies have inside the lens space. But these lenses are really impressive. One of the things that people didn't like was the more modern style greenish color of flare that the original Vistas introduced. I actually thought those flares were awesome, and I thought the Vista ones were even more awesome. But other people out there, that wasn't what they were into. So that green has been attenuated from the Vista C's. It is now a blue and red flare. So it is, it's a different look. And for people out there who were not into the more modern flare, then or modern colors, then they're really going to like this. So,
excellent.
So Ben, I think that just about does it for us. Where can people find you if they want to track you down?
You can find me at benrock.com or neptunesalad at bluesky. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
Can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com or LinkedIn. Quite a few people connecting via LinkedIn. So, cool.
I got a few of those too.
All right. So, Ben, who do we have to thank this week? Who made this show possible?
As always, our kick-ass producer, Alana Cody, getting the interviews. We had, I think you and I have both been pretty busy interviewing people the last week or so, and I feel like it's like that last push before the Oscar season, and hopefully we're about to have our Janelle Riley Oscar wrap up pretty soon, and Alana was talking to me about that this morning. So Alana, thank you for continuing to kick ass. We got to thank Michael Indispensable Dispenza for
that makes you grin every time. Every time you say that, you're so happy with that pun.
It's a dad joke. Yeah, it's a good, it's a solid dad joke. For editing us and hopefully making us not sound like dopes. And last but not least, Kay Zalatracci. Extra special thanks to Kay for filling in for you last week.
Yeah, thanks, Kay. Appreciate it.
Yay.
Yeah.
You can check out Kay's work at musicbykays.com. He created every scrap of music that you've heard on this entire podcast. He created it. He's an amazing composer and lots of other stuff, as we always talk about. So go to musicbykays.com, drop him a line, tell him that you like his work. That's all he needs to hear.
Yeah, that's a wonderful moment of gratitude that you did there, Ben. Do you want to take us out?
No, why don't you take us out? Because you've been off in Australia and having adventures. So take us out Australia style.
Oh, I'll do my best. Thanks for tuning in. G'day.
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 This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.